We should do Bye Bye Birdie. I was in Bye Bye Birdie.
I was too.
Were you?
Hello, Mr. Svenkel. This is Marty Robson. Can I speak to Penelope? And I was the guy with the breaking voice.
That's a good song. It's called Telephone Hour.
Yeah, that's a good song.
Yeah. I was a Shriner. I was in the dance scene with the lady who was, I remember the song.
Pick a little dog, little, pick a little dog, little, cheep, 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 duck, little. That's Pajama Game.
We did not do that.
I did that. I thought I saw you.
Hello, and welcome to Tell Me About Your Song, the podcast where I talk to musicians and songwriters about a song they've written. Today, I'm talking to Jeff Griffin and Sonny Rolley of the band The Sentimental Favorites. So next, we're going to talk about a song that Jeff wrote called 20 Anymore, also from the Unrelenting Sentimental Favorites. So where would you like to start with this song?
I'd like to tell you the story of that song.
Sure.
I wrote the song a couple years ago. I was raised in a sort of a magical town that was one of the first planned communities in the tri-state area. I grew up in New York, this town called Bronxville, New York, that was, you know, they drained the pond to put the school in and everything was laid out by plan. There was no reason for anybody to live there. It was a true suburb in that sense. But instead of being a Levittown prefab suburb, it was sort of a well-designed playground for the rich. And when I lived there, and it still is to this day, an immensely well-financed, well-heeled, homogeneous town that really doesn't have a history. So people move there because they are making a lot of money and they have moved generally in the last generation or two out of lower middle class or poverty. So it's a town that where people move there because they think they're going to be around old money preppy people, but there is no heart or soul or past in that town. And it's just a lot of people trying to join something in progress, all showing up at the same party at the same time. It was a funny town. It was a fantasy town, and I was immensely happy there. I lived across the street from the school and really had run of the place, went to school, lived in the same house my whole life, went to school in the same building my whole life, same friends. People didn't move in and out. And from when I was very, very young, I had the sense that I was going to be in a lot of trouble when I had to leave. I knew it took a lot of money and a lot of work to keep a family there, more work than I would be willing to put in. And also, I knew early on that I didn't really have the tools to deal with reality all that well. So growing up, I remember a deep sense of dread all along with this, that someday I was going to have to leave. And sure enough, it did turn out to be a hard place to leave. When I was 18, I went off to college, and very quickly my parents took off, and then I avoided going back there ever again. I really gave it a wide berth because it was too heartbreaking to go there. But I did go back there for a funeral. I've gone back there for a couple of funerals. People's fathers are starting to die. I first went back there. I had a friend, Mark, when I was very, very little. He and his mom lived in Bronxville, and his father was dead, which was a very exotic thing. And then his mother married a man who had lost his wife. So the idea that we had second marriages, that Mark now had a stepbrother, was very, very exotic. It was the Brady Bunch scenario, except with just two kids. And this was before people really started getting divorced. And so sort of fascinated by that family. And when I grew up, well, it was probably 10 years ago, Mark's stepfather passed away. And so I went back to Bronxville for the funeral. I went to the funeral. A couple of old friends were there. Everything in the town was just the way I remembered it. A couple of us in the back row, and the church was absolutely packed. And Mark's stepfather was buried, and in all of the tributes and prayers and eulogies that people offered in the church, nobody mentioned Mark or his mother. That were completely written out of this guy's story. His initial family and the woman he had married first, the rest of the church was filled with that whole extended family. And he was written, the part of the story that I had seen was totally written out of history. It was really odd and surreal and really kind of hurtful to all of us that were showing up to represent this other side of the story. When I left, so that was a really odd feeling waiting through that whole service and waiting for Mark and his mom to get mentioned, and they didn't. And I left and went up the street. I was a punk rotten, you know, Smiths, REM kind of new wave kid when I was there, with long hair and a trench coat. And here I was in my black suit for a funeral with a crew cut. And something about the black suit was so different from what I was wearing when I was a teenager and lived there. But also there's something about sort of Men in Black about the whole thing, that I was on a special assignment. I felt like a spy walking through my old town, and everything was just where it had been. And when I got into the middle of town and stood at the corner and saw Periello's Pizza and the drugstore and Lang's Deli, just in Park Place Pete's, all in the places that they were before, and this town that used to be so much my home, and no one recognized me, I was sad that nobody recognized me. And then I realized that nobody I knew really was still there at all. And of course, nobody knew me. I saw all these archetypes walking by. I was like, oh, that was the kind of kid that I was probably. But it wasn't me walking by. And then I'd see a car drive by with a bunch of football players, and I'd be like, oh, that's Dave and those guys. Except this is 20 years later, and I know it's not them. And I did see my high school girlfriend walk by. But of course, it wasn't her, because she clearly had moved on in life. And this person I was looking at was 16 years old. And I was remembering Lynette from when she was 16. But that couldn't possibly have been her. But it was spooky to see her. And spooky also to have her look up and look right through me, because I didn't look like what I once was. And she wasn't actually even the person that I thought she was. And it was a spooky experience. And so I wrote that song.
Earlier, you were sort of talking about sentimental favorite songs as songs with no subtext. There it is. It's all there. But this song, you gave that whole narrative, and only a little piece of that is in here. So.
Yeah, that's right. Not a lot of made to the page. Well, so that goes to the, and if I was Jim Morrison, I might have sat down and tried to get it all in one song. And earlier in my life, I probably would have tried to get it all into one song. But often my attempts at doing that, they've often collapsed under their own weight. And so as I've gotten older and freer, I've been much more comfortable saying, this will remind me of the subtext, and I can relive it, and I can get excited about it. But it also, I'm just going to take this one little aspect of it and do a great job of it, rather than doing a complicated song that just refers back obliquely to all of these things that I was saying that no one would ever hope to get. Let me just communicate one line about it, and then I'll have my own private story. But there'll be something that will be reasonable and satisfying and not just evocative to the listener.
I think that your songs, though, have more of a background story that doesn't necessarily get just told. Like, this one has a much larger story, but it's simplified down into this song. And I know a lot of backstories to why you wrote a lot of your songs, but it's not so obvious. Like, a lot of your songs from Plymouth Rock are the same way. There's obviously something, a story behind this, but you're not getting that in the song. Whereas mine are, I'm thinking about this, the end.
Well, I'd like to think that some of the backstory comes into the song, in the sense that a song like 20 Anymore, you may not know the details of it, but first of all, you know, I thoroughly explain what it is that I'm actually trying to say, which is this moment of confusion in my hometown. And this clue is somebody I knew and thought was cute and thought they probably still were. But I hope that it still has the same sort of sadness and uncanniness. So I hope that some of that still carries through.
It does, you've taken this thing that you're thinking about and artfully turned it into this nice little pop song. I'll give an example of one of our songs that I wrote about a girl from high school. When I was 17, I'd go to school even if I was really sick because medicine didn't work, but Adrian did the trick.
Mm-hmm.
But like, that's it.
Mm-hmm. But there's something super sad and teenage in that song, though.
No, I know, but it's... edit that out.
No, but, well, I get what you're saying. I don't want to get too compare your songs and my songs.
No, I know. But I think there is quite a bit of difference when it comes to what's being laid out. I will say I moved away when I was 17 from where I grew up, and I moved to Baltimore. I was there for 6 years, and then moved up here. When I moved up to Providence, I would go back to Baltimore two or three times a year, and every time I would get off the highway, and a block off the highway, I would see somebody I knew walking down the street. And that happened for years. And then it would be like I'd get off the highway and the next neighborhood I'd see somebody, or I'd stop at a store and I'd see somebody I knew. And now I go down there and it's like a totally different town. And back home, like exactly the same. Like, I don't know any of them. They don't know me. You start to feel like you don't have a home.
In my case, the town is exactly the same. And even the people that are there and the things that they're choosing to do and even the clothes they're wearing are pretty much the same as they were 30 years ago. So actually, the thing that's changed is me. It's not that my town isn't there anymore. It's just that nobody remembers me. So it's a weird feeling of being disappeared.
When you run into people who you knew and like they've now had 20, 30 years of their own life and you've had yours and you're completely different people with really very little connection now, there's no going back. For a long time, for me, it was like I have these bases that I could go back to, and now those bases are gone. In Providence, most of my friends here have been here, and they all have this shared history, and not having that with the people here and not having any connection with the people who I did have that with, you just start floating off in the limbo.
I feel a strong connection with you in that sense too, and we're still passionate about a lot of the things that we were passionate about when we were 14 and 15 years old, and also there's a lot of things that we're eager to put behind ourselves. But I do feel like, I'm not sure we've ever talked about this, but I feel like we're both exiles, but I know that I've consciously decided this would be my last stop. Like, let's see if we can do it here and put down roots and make a family. It would be much harder for me to have gotten involved in the band or become as good friends with you as I have if I felt like this was another town that you were trying.
I've almost been here longer than anywhere else.
But... And your two kids, they're Rhode Islanders. They're from Rhode Island.
Yeah, it's weird. Like,
you're stuck with that now.
Which isn't a problem, but it's weird because it's like I'm always going to be like, Pam has that connection with them. She's from here. They're from here. But I'm not from here.
So Sonny's wife, Pam, they are living now in the town where Pam grew up. They're going to go to the school that Pam went to school in.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of the reason we moved back there, because she knew it was a good school.
And in the town that I grew up in, it's a town that's 100 years old now. But people rarely stay. There's nothing to do. It's an odd, odd thing to move back.
I had teachers who had taught the parents and went to school with the grandparents of the kids in my class kind of thing. But we moved there when I was in second grade. And so we were outsiders. Like, I was there from like second.
You're new.
Yeah, I was there from second grade to graduation, but it was always like, you don't have a history in this town.
And here in Providence, I still feel like I'm new. In a lot of circles, I'm new. And then in other circles, I'm the boring old man. I mean, I went to the cable car this morning to see that movie, and I was joking with somebody. It's changed hands since I worked there in the 90s, and I ran into somebody else that was part of the family that ran it in the 90s. We were joking about how long it took us to stop wanting to talk to the people behind the counter about how we worked there a long time ago.
Yeah.
And
they don't care.
How, even though I know, almost like I wanted to say, I know that you don't care. I know this is a worst case scenario, that there's a guy standing there telling you where the fridge used to be, but I just can't stop myself. And I don't know how I went from being new here to being the boring old guy and never got to do a lot of the middle stuff.
Are you the guy who, when you do go back home and say you're, you know, driving around with your wife or your kids, and you go, oh, that's where so-and-so lived, and that's where so-and-so lived. Like,
oh,
it's
God.
All I do whenever I go home with somebody.
And they don't care.
They don't care at all. They couldn't care less.
And you can't stop.
No.
And like, and to get back to the song, like, I wanted to walk up to the people that I was seeing and been like, you know, I did this. And they really, like, in the middle of a suburban town, like a man in a black suit and a crew cut and sunglasses walks up to you and says, I did that same thing 20 years ago.
I am your future self.
You better put out that cigarette. Those things will kill you. Oh, God. Boring old man. I thought I saw you. She looked about 20. And I know you're not 20 anymore. I moved her up to 20 because there was a sexuality about being 16 that was not about what the song was about.
Isn't it weird when you
But
hear,
if
like,
I had said 16, it would have been, oh, like you're craving like high school girls. And that's not, so 20 seemed like a more reasonable age to be nostalgic about and to be displaced from. It's funny too, when you cross, I mean, the number of like sort of heteronormative things, but then also like pop song-o-normative things. Whenever you cross gender, people assume that it's a lover that you're speaking to. And then often just even when you just say you, people will assume that it's a woman that I went out with. Which it was in this case, but I have plenty of songs where I've got myself actually into complicated relationships with people. Like, the songs have then messed up the relationship with the person because they know the song's about them. And since it's a song, I must be in love with them. I'm sure that you're still cute in a 40 kind of way. But you don't look 20. Anymore.
One of the things I like about the song is the lyrics are all about this other person, but it's really about the singer's own aging, even though that's only really in there by implication.
Yeah. I would say that the person writing this song is then also trying to reach out and acknowledge the fact that the person that he's addressing is also gotten older and that the years don't need to be such a yawning divide, and try to connect and be like, oh, I'm 42. But boy, aren't we old. And there is a way to look cute in a 40 kind of way. That line often gets a laugh when we're delivering it correctly. I'd like to think it's because people are thinking, oh yeah, 40, you can be cute in 40.
40's the new 20.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get to.
So I wanted to ask you about the use of Link Wray's rumble in this song.
Bill Doggett's rumble? Was it rumble?
Rumble, but Link Wray, yeah.
What song did Bill Doggett did Raunchy? Yeah, that was just, that was what I was singing the song to the tune of in my head. It's also a lot like Roadrunner, which is a Jonathan Richman song, but there's a spaciousness and spookiness that I wanted. In a previous life, I would have knocked myself out to write a bridge that would takes it to a place beyond that song, and it would have been sort of papered over a little bit more. But I don't think we needed it to be papered over, especially sort of post De La Soul. It's like you can just sort of take something fun and run with it. It's also really great the way that Sonny is able to do the rest of the band just by whacking at the strings.
Most of the guitar parts that I do, even on my own songs, Jeff will come up with the lead guitar, you know, but he needs to tell me what to hit on the guitar.
The band started with Sonny bringing a lot of songs, and I was like, oh, I have an idea. I'm watching him perform and saying, oh, it'd be great if somebody had a guitar and was doing this. And so the process started with him. He would come in with just a cappella songs, and I would figure out something to do along with it. And that was often when a lot of melodic and harmonic structure was put on the songs. I'd be like, oh, it sounds like you're just kind of going from that chord to that chord. And it would force Sonny to actually pin down the melody and what he heard in his head. You've been inspirational to me, the sense of getting things out the door and being comfortable with what constitutes the song. I have managed to shake in the last 5 years the sense of the perfect and sad pop song, and it no longer feels like my life's work. I feel like I've done it a couple of times, but the weird thing for me is that once I stopped, I didn't realize how much energy I was putting into that, because once I let go of that, I was like, you know what? I don't need to hide the fact that we're just playing Raunchy by Bill Justice under this song. I don't need to like change it to another, make it minor instead of major or whatever. We'll just leave it the way it is.
And Keith Munslow recorded it, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. And then we actually had it mastered, which was a crazy day. Yeah. And it took the entire day. It was like 9 hours or something. It was nuts. It was a really long time. It was just Jeff and I on a couch looking at this guy's back as he sat at this big thing and listened to our songs over and over and over all day long. It's like, he's going to shoot himself.
Yeah. Well, the moment you start to even twist a dial, the song's over. It's also an awkward thing about mastering, even the recording of these songs.
Yeah. The Phoenix is slightly over 2 minutes, and then this one is, I don't know, a minute and a half or something.
Yeah, epic.
Right.
Yeah.
But there are some 35-second songs on this album.
Yeah, like a lot of very short songs.
Everybody's working, and no one wants to be around someone who doesn't need a job. Yeah, everybody's working, everybody's working, and no one wants to be around someone who doesn't need a job. But I guess if that were me, gifted with the ability to not have to go get a job, I definitely would not rob myself of such a lazy thing, and someone else would have to sing that. Everybody's working, and no one wants to be around someone who doesn't need a job.
It's odd that we picked these two songs, because not that we have such a rich and deep palette, but these guys are sort of the same color. I wouldn't put them next to each other in a set or something. They're both spacious. They both have the most like instrumental room. I mean, often with our words, the songs are just tumbles of words. And in terms of the way that they perform for the crowd, there are a couple of like, wait a second, oh, I see what's happening in this song, moments that we milk. It's very, very satisfying. And sometimes it's just somebody shifting their weight in their seat. But it's very satisfying when you hear people click.
Mm-hmm.
When you hear it click with the audience that they know, they're like, oh my God.
I think we're much better lyrically than musically, maybe. I mean, this is like a lame thing that any musician would say. You got to listen to my music, my lyrics, man. But it's kind of true, because otherwise, like, it's just noise that you're annoyed with. like, stop that infernal racket.
You say that, but people say the song's very, very catchy. People say that they have the songs in their head and it's driving them crazy.
Yeah, I think that... Not in a like cheerful
no
way.
Right, yes.
Right.
What do you say in response to that? People say that to me too. I know what I say. I'm just curious what you
say.
Oh,
well, I'm excited and flattered, yeah. And I say that I'd love to hear you sing it someday.
Oh, that's great. You know?
Like, let's make a record.
That's a good one.
Let's do a cover record.
I was at a show and it's in the audience, and a girl came up who was really into our record, and she came up and she's like, "I love your record. I listen to it every night before I go to bed. Like, it's just like my favorite thing." And I'm like, oh, wow, that's great. Thanks. And she walks away. And then her parents walked over, you know, moments later, and, you know, said hello. And then they're like, she listens to your record every night. And I was like, ah, thanks. That's great.
If people want to hear more of your music,
give us a call. We'll come to your house. We'll play a show.
We really will play shows anywhere. And we're willing to... we take requests, so we will amend our songs and our song selection according to whatever the context is. We have a kid-friendly show, and then we have an adult show. We also have two records that are available on Bandcamp and also through CD Baby somehow.
And iTunes.
And 75 or less, and the iTunes. And a bunch of them have videos that you can see at our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/sentimentalfavorites.
And that's how people would get in touch with you, is through Facebook?
Yeah, yeah. Please do.
Great. Well, my name's Jacob Haller. My website's music.jwgh.org if you want to hear any of my music or see what I'm playing. I've created a blog for the Tell Me About Your Song podcast. It's on Tumblr and can be seen at yoursongpodcast.tumblr.com. I post show notes there, and I'll have links to all of the sites and things that we've been talking about. I've also created a Facebook group for Tell Me About Your Song. Search for Tell Me About Your Song. You'll find it. I post there whenever I have a new episode or I see something that I think people will be interested in. You can certainly comment there or send me a message through that. Tell Me About Your Song is also on iTunes. You can subscribe to it there or rate and review it. That helps people find the podcast. So that's it. We're going to go out by listening to 20 Anymore. And if you missed it, last week I posted the first half of my conversation with Sonny and Jeff, where we talked about Sonny's song, The Phoenix. So thanks for listening, and talk to you next time.
Thanks, Jake.
Thanks, Jake. I thought I saw you. She looked about 20. I know you're not 20. I'm sure that you're still cute in a 40 kind of way, but you don't look 20 anymore. Have been 20. I know you're not 20 anymore. Sentimental Favorites is a band name that I came up with. I just wanted to tell you.
It's true.
And it's the best best named band I've ever been in.
I think, remember right before that, we were going to have the band name. To ensure no audience, our band name is going to be Blood Drive.
Oh, you know, I've always...
Tonight, Blood Drive. No, but boy, that was funny. I made myself laugh.
My band name along those lines was closed due to health code violations.
Yeah, well, those are all pre-internet names too, right? They're all like names that you would hang in the window of a place. They all assume that you're going to hang up a flyer.
Mm. Yeah,
which people or a marquee. Anymore.
If a marquee, that's why X's name is X, because the X zine was like,
I just want to see a big X on the marquee. So
there they go. Mm. Triple X. Hot to Trot. Hot to Trot 3.
Bare Naked Ladies.
Oh.
Nice.
Let me ask you about
a song that just does that.
It was the Crash Test Dummies. The song is called Mm-mm-mm-mm.
Yep. Let me ask a question.
And there was also the band. There was a band called Judge.
Oh my god, I've completely lost control.
Judge?
No, Judd. They only did a 7-inch, and both sides, just all their lyrics were Judd. And they would go Judd.
Every Thursday.
You were saying?